Welcome to Your Own Health and Fitness. I'm health integrationist Lena Berman with Dr. Jeffrey Fawcett. We come to you weekly with a critical, independent voice on the politics and practice of health and the environment. Sound becomes noise when it's an annoyance. While music is healing, noise can damage our hearing and cause stress-related disease. While what's considered noise is individual, the range at which it damages our hearing and even our health is not. According to the World Health Organization, exposures in excess of 85 decibels for more than 8 hours is potentially hazardous. 85 decibels is equivalent to the sound of heavy truck traffic. Children are most at risk, and as many as 80% of elementary school children use iPod-like music players for long periods at high volumes. Additionally, even if noise doesn't wake you from sleep, sleeping with noise in an excess of only 30 decibels causes sleep disturbances, high blood pressure, heart rate, and pulse, changes in respiration, cardiac arrhythmias, and body movements. Since a typical daytime quiet neighborhood is about 45 decibels, it isn't hard to imagine that many neighborhoods exceed 30 decibels at night. So where does that place noise on the list of exposures that contribute to illness? Stay tuned for a discussion about noise pollution and health. First, an editorial about this week's health news by Jeffrey Fawcett, Ph.D.
Thank you, Lena. Every so often, the mainstream media makes a big splash about some study that allegedly shows that vitamins don't do any good. The story is often helped by weak evidence that they might even cause harm. The latest assault in this war on vitamins occurred 2 weeks ago with headlines such as, "Vitamins Seen as No Help in Heart Disease." This particular study was published in the Journal of the American Medical Association and was hailed as one of the most comprehensive of its kind. It covered 10 years and followed almost 15,000 participants. These participants happened to be male physicians. They were divided into two groups. One group took 400 international units of vitamin E each day. The second group took 500 milligrams of vitamin C along with a vitamin E each day. The study was designed to see what effect this would have on a broad range of cardiovascular events, heart attacks, strokes, congestive heart failure, angina, and so-called revascularization, such as bypass surgery. Overall, no statistically significant effect was found. There were two exceptions. Vitamin E alone was associated with fewer heart attacks, but it was also associated with more hemorrhagic strokes. I'll start with just some of the things that are wrong with this study. Like most of the studies of its ilk, this one was designed to use vitamins as though they were pharmaceuticals. That means researchers ignored important issues such as each person's initial nutrient status and whether the dose each received actually met their physiological need. For example, 500 milligrams extra of vitamin C is a fairly low dose, and we don't know what form of vitamin E was used. Different forms have different effects. The class of the subjects leads me to another weakness of the study. Would this study design have shown a positive result from 400 international units of vitamin E and 300 milligrams of vitamin C if it had been conducted on subjects living below the poverty line, instead of male physicians who we can safely assume live comfortably? I know of at least one study that asked that question and found that the answer was yes. Although the quality of the science is a problem, the more important problem is the media event into which such studies are made. These news items affect decisions people make about their health. Some people see a headline that says vitamins are no use and so decide to stop taking them. After all, it's in the news, so it must be true. The point is most definitely not that people should critically analyze every piece of health news they see or hear. That should already be done by the science journalists who report these studies and fail utterly to present a critical perspective on matters that affect suffering, life, and death. That's why I regard reports like this in the mainstream media as useful for little more than information on what big-shot institutions think we should know. And even then, they often mangle the message. As I examined this latest study about vitamins, I thought of the people who actually know what they're doing with nutrients for therapy and for primary prevention. So I visited the website of the Orthomolecular Medicine News Service. Here are the titles of some recent news releases. Vitamin C shows slows cancer down. Vitamin E prevents lung cancer. Vitamin B6 reduces colon cancer. And vitamin D stops cancer, cuts risk in half. These are all news releases reporting on research. You probably didn't see them in your daily newspaper or on the evening news. There are a number of reasons. Some of these reasons include the NIH didn't fund the research didn't come from big shot institutions, the research wasn't published in a big shot journal, it wasn't promoted by the PR department of the sponsoring big shot institution, and on and on. In short, it's not respectable. And, as we all know, if it's not respectable, it can't be true. So the next time you read or hear about some study that claims that vitamins don't do any good, pause and ask yourself, what news didn't reach me? A transcript of this editorial is available on the blog at yourownhealthandfitness.org. I'm Jeffrey Fawcett. Take care of yourself.
Dr. Jeffrey Fawcett's an environmental economist and writer who produces this show with me and is primary author of our book, Too Much Medicine, Not Enough Health. And now let's get to our topic for today, noise, pollution, and health. My guest is Dr. Lewis Hagler. He's a physician, retired physician, graduated from the University of Colorado School of Medicine with a specialty in general internal medicine. He served 21 years in the United States Army in several research laboratories that were part of the Army's Medical Research and Development Command, and after retiring from the military, worked in the pharmaceutical industry for 20 years in drug safety. In retirement, the noise of the world overwhelmed Dr. Hagler, and he began his career as an anti-noise activist. He comes to us as the co-author of a review article entitled Noise Pollution, a Modern Plague, published in Southern Medical Journal in March of 2007. And we're very pleased to have you with us today by phone. Welcome.
Thank you very much. Nice to be with you.
Same here. Nice to be with you. I'm interested in hearing about how you came to the conclusion that noise is a form of pollution.
Well, it wasn't hard. If you look at, if you just consider what we define as pollution, it's defined as the presence of harmful chemical, physical, or biological agents in air, water, food, or soil. And they're harmful because they adversely affect the health and well-being of biological systems that are exposed to them. So we view air pollution with particulates as being a form of pollution, and rightly so. We also should view air pollution with energy as a form of pollution, and we do that in part because we consider radioactivity a form of pollution. We fail to do so with sound, which is a form of energy that that can be a pollutant in our environment.
You've given me some very interesting statistics I'm going to read. The World Health Organization says that noise pollution costs each government 3% of its annual gross domestic product. And for the state of California, it's the sixth largest economy, which is the sixth largest economy that was anyway, I don't know about now. And that 3% represents over 50. There's too many zeros for me.
I think it's billion.
Holy moly. Is that what billion looks like? Really? That's it just goes on and on. It's 50 and then it's just zero. According to the World Health Organization as well, they keep popping up about this, about 3% of all fatal heart attacks are noise-induced. So that means 4,000 people in California alone.
Yeah, can I jump in, Lena?
Yeah, jump.
That 3%, I just looked at some statistics to today, there's roughly 8 million people a year who die in the United States from the cause of death is recorded as acute myocardial infarction.
Mm-hmm.
If you take 3% of that, that means there's 250,000 deaths a year that are induced by noise.
Mm-hmm.
That's lost parents and brothers and sisters. mothers and siblings. It's lost taxpayers. It's lost wage earners. It's lost of productive citizens to our society. And those losses are really easily preventable if we had a will to do it.
Well, let me just, I'm headed in that direction. We'll also go back over the mechanisms that cause cardiovascular disease. Extrapolating from figures published by the United States Environmental Protection Agency, where are they now? Nearly 10 million Californians live in areas where the daily average noise level exceeds those as being identified as safe. And this despite a congressional act that says, quote, it is the policy of the United States government to promote an environment for all Americans free from noise that jeopardizes health and welfare, unquote. There are, however, no federal programs that work toward this goal. So is there a history of the government trying to regulate it, and where are we now with that?
Well, there's an interesting and very sad history. I don't have a lot of really first-hand knowledge, but I've read about this. In 1972, Congress passed a Noise Control Act, and part of what you just read was contained in that act. And as part of that act, they funded an agency called the Office of Noise Abatement and Control, ONAC. And ONAC began a very, very energetic and ambitious program of looking into various sources of noise and partnering with people in academia and elsewhere in industry to try to do something about noise, to bring noise levels under control. There was talk of, you know, of putting noise labels on commercial products so people would have an idea of how noisy the product was that they were getting. And this program really was getting rolling. And then in 1982, while Ronald Reagan was president, the program was defunded. So you have an agency with rules and regulations, but no funding for it, and therefore no ability to enforce what regulations were in existence. There have been repeated attempts at getting ONAC refunded. Nita Lowry, who is a representative from the state of New York, has been instrumental in this. But there have been a number of congressional people who have worked at trying to get ONAC refunded, but each time there's been an effort to do so, it's just died. So we're essentially left with these very lofty and high sounding phrases about protecting human health and well-being, that's the policy of our government, but in essence the government has done nothing in that regard. And it's not only the federal government. I've talked to the people at the California State Department of Health, and they have no ongoing program in noise abatement or mitigation. It's just under the radar. No one seems to be interested.
There's something in the U.S. Constitution also that guarantees us domestic tranquility, which, as we all know, can be destroyed by one obsessively barking dog, you know.
Yes.
And they don't come with labels. So labeling, just in case anybody needs to be reminded, would be things like leaf blowers, lawn mowers, motorcycles, I would hope.
Any product that makes noise.
Yeah.
And in Europe, the European Union, in 2002, the European Union issued a directive that was aimed at controlling environmental noise. And they require now an energy label on all commercially available products that talk about how much power they consume, electrical or gas or whatever, and also how much noise they make. And those are now available to the consumer, so you can make an informed decision. If you're looking at two products that are comparable, you can pick the one that's the quietest.
I have always assumed that there were two reasons. I've never been able to understand the amount of noise that we... I suspect that there's I've always had a feeling that some of it is because, I can't say it's only men, but that people, in fact, like apes, make noise when they want people to know they're in their territory. In fact, birds do too. I mean, animals tend to make noise to let other people, you know, their others know that, that this is their territory or whatever. And I think that humans have this kind of unconscious thing too. It's the only thing I can make sense of. But I haven't been able to understand why there isn't some regulation on, since automobiles have to have mufflers, how come these enormous power tools don't have to have mufflers? And I've assumed that it's partly, A, because people using those tools want it to go, you know, want that horrible sound, and B, because it's expensive to muffle them.
That may be true. I think it's also true that we're awash in noise because we citizens haven't made our will known to the legislators and insisted or demanded that products be made quieter.
I should let people know that you're listening to Your Own Health and Fitness. I'm Lena Berman. I'm on the phone with Lewis Hagler, MD, who has co-authored with Lisa Goines a review article that was published in the Southern Medical Journal called Noise Pollution, a Modern Plague.
Lena, I'll put in a plug for Lisa Goines. She happens to be my wife.
Aw.
So.
Aw. That's nice. And she's an RN.
Yes.
I guess I should ask you what the two of you hoped would happen by publishing this review article. I mean, I'm very grateful that you wrote it because it's extremely clear. I really think anyone reading this, even people who maybe haven't been thinking about it so much, would feel like getting involved reading this review article. It's very well written.
Thank you. Well, I'll tell you what we hope to accomplish. In speaking to people about noise, people sometimes get it, and sometimes they don't. And it seemed to me that as I talk to members of city council, or as I talk to, you know, people who are potentially in decision-making positions, police departments or whatever, if I went with a published review article from a peer-reviewed journal, that was not now propaganda, it was not my opinion, it was good science, it was a reporting on good science that had been done by others, because I can't claim credit for doing the scientific investigation. I only put it together from what I gathered from the work of others. But I thought it would be useful to have a document like that to say, look, here's the problem. If you don't believe me, read the article, look at the references, then make a decision. You know, there's a problem, and it needs to be dealt with. So I had hoped, and I had also hoped that, because I think health professionals are going to have to lead the way in this effort the same way they led the effort in smoking cessation. So,
do you think that doctors led the effort? I thought it was consumers.
Well, there was a huge effort by physicians. There was a group at UC San Francisco.
There's Dan Glantz.
Yes.
Yes, of course.
Yes.
And
you know, there were a lot of people on board on that issue.
Yep. So, yeah, he's been very good.
So, you know, I'm not denying that consumers themselves had a voice in this, mm-hmm. and I hope consumers would have a voice in the noise issue.
Yes, me too.
It's an analogous problem. It's mm-hmm. It's an unwanted pollutant that's imposed on us by others against our will at times and places and volumes that we have no choice over.
Well, a term that's been used by activists who are fighting other forms of pollution, like the burgeoning amount of radiation that we're exposed to through wireless devices and the anti-spray, you know, the pesticide spraying thing, all these people, a term that someone used was that it's trespassing. And it's trespassing with the potential to damage your health. So it isn't just an annoyance. It actually, I mean, people think that part of the reason that people don't complain about noise is because they think it's an annoyance and it's their problem that they're annoyed, and we live with other people and you have to make compromises, and you shouldn't, this is America and people should be free to have a barking dog and have it outside or whatever, it, you know, whatever it is, and just dogs. But, you know, I think that there's this attitude that forgets, as you've pointed out so well, the both of you have, you and Lisa both, that this is a form of pollution that causes very devastating health effects. Now, I'm wondering when the World Health Organization got involved, because they certainly are kind of not jumping in on some of the other issues that we're concerned about, but they did get involved, and they have been involved. Do you have a sense of when they got involved and how they did that to begin with?
I really don't.
Okay,
but I know. But I know. I know, because I have the document here, that there was a massive document on environmental noise that was published in 1985, I believe, and it. The article that you have, that Lisa and I wrote, followed the format of that article in terms of the way we reported on the adverse health effects of noise, you know, hearing impairment, spoken communication, sleep, cardiovascular, mental health, task performance, and so on. We followed the outline that was used in the document from the World Health Organization.
It isn't difficult to get your article. If people want to get it, they can, I think, email you. Is that correct?
They can, yes.
Or can they just Google you and find it?
They can Google me, but I can give you the, I can, if...
You want to? You want us to have it on our website?
Is sure, it? I can give it
okay.
to you.
Okay. We'll have a downloadable form on our website at yourownhealthandfitness.org. You just have to give us a day or so to get it. And, oh, it's already up there? Oh, Jeffrey can put it up there. He's got the document. So, all right, and I have, yeah. All right, so the World Health Organization is interesting because many of the, as you go through the seven most important issues in terms of health effects, many of the research and many of these statistics are coming from the World Health Organization. And I might mention that your article ends with 46 citations to research. So that's a lot of research. Let's start going through this, lest people forget, you know, what we're talking about. Now, one of the things that's important to talk about is this whole issue of decibels, because one of the things I've noticed going into the city these days, and for me it would be San Francisco, for people in other parts of the country it'll be other big cities, but now restaurants do have the sound rating, and I won't go into a restaurant if it has more than two or three bells, which is about 65 to 75 decibels, which means that you can still hear each other talk, you know, in that situation. But most restaurants are 5, 6, or they have a bomb. And
yes.
I had one experience of being in a restaurant like that, where I kind of couldn't escape, and I was thinking, okay, is it the case that everybody in the restaurant is drunk and they're shouting at each other? But it had to do with the acoustics. And again, you know, you start to wonder whether part of this is, because I didn't, as a child of the 60s, I didn't understand the level of noise at rock concerts then, and now they make your ears bleed. So you know, you mentioned, this is very interesting, that people are different in terms of their sensitivity to sound. Not everybody responds the same way. And I've always been sensitive to it, and easily rattled by it. So I never liked loud noise, but it seems to me that people do like really loud noise. So I want to kind of help people to understand, whether they like it or not, what the possible downsides to exposing yourself to this. It's not benign, and as you point out, ears do not get used to loud noise. They just get damaged.
That's right.
So let's start with number one, which is physical damage to hearing. The statistic I have here is that children are more vulnerable, which makes sense. They're developing. And it's interesting that children that are still fetuses, if the mother is exposed to really loud noise, it damages the hearing of the fetus.
There's been work that shows that the developing fetus has a functional auditory system by about 24 weeks of gestation. And so when you're dealing with a newborn, you're dealing with a human person who is very aware of everything that goes on in the audible environment. Newborns have little ability to discriminate or to block out. They hear everything, and the startle. I mean, we're all aware of the, you know, if you make a loud noise, that babies startle. That's a reflex that they come into the world with, and they are born with a kind of a built-in set of patterns. If you expose babies to noises that are loud, their heart rate slows, their oxygen saturation goes down, their breathing gets disrupted, and you can actually shut babies down and they'll start to die just from noise exposure. Mm-hmm. Which is why my wife is a neonatal intensive care unit nurse, and she's written a paper on the need for not only for quiet in the nurseries, which is something that's developed over the last 20 years or so, but also for quiet in the home that you take a newborn baby into. There's a lot of reasons why babies need to be in a quiet environment. They need quiet so that they can concentrate on the voices of their caregivers, their mother and their father or their siblings. And ultimately, they need that so that they can begin to grow and develop normal language acquisition, and that carries into school learning, and it's a whole train of things that are related. So it's a big deal. It's a big deal. It's important.
It might be useful at this point to mention, if people haven't already figured this out, it's kind of obvious, but that the primary problem with noise pollution, part of it is that the ears and the cochlear mechanisms in the ear are damaged. So, you know, it's one of those things that gets damaged and lost over time. But the other problem is that the body will mobilize a fight-or-flight response in response to loud noise, that it stimulates a very, very extreme stress response.
Yes, that's part of that primitive reflex that newborns come into the world with, and we never lose that. We human beings are hardwired to interpret loud noise as a threat. And that's not on a conscious level. That's on a subconscious level. It goes on in the very primitive part of our brain. But when we hear noise, that's loud or that's unwanted, because unwanted noise, unwanted sound, which is noise causes, it triggers this reflex. And what happens is you get a whole train of neurologic events that trigger endocrine events that cause hormones to pour out, the so-called stress hormones, which raise blood pressure and increase heart rate and do a lot of things that over the long haul, if these events are repeated, they have harmful effects on many systems in the body. The cardiovascular system is a prime target.
You need to only watch your animal companions to know that the response to noise is a response that's natural and designed to protect you. That if you hear, you know, if Jeffrey gets up on the roof for some reason, the cats all start going, you know, they start looking up at the roof. So there, it's, and we deafen ourselves to the point in many ways where we can't respond appropriately to a stressor when that happens if we're completely stressed out. I want to come back to the physical damage to hearing and what decibels it happens at and all that. But first I want to take just a bit of a musical break, if you might. And this is Lena Berman, Your Own Health and Fitness. I'm on the phone with Lewis Hagler, MD, who with his wife Lisa Goines, who is an RN, have written the review article, Noise Pollution, a Modern Plague, and we're talking about the health effects of noise pollution. We're going to take a musical break. Please stay with us. We'll be right back. Welcome back. This is Your Own Health and Fitness. Visit our website, yourownhealthandfitness.org, all spelled out, for easier extended access to our over 600 archive shows with our library card feature. Get a free stream of this week's show. Find out about our book, Too Much Medicine, Not Enough Health. And there's lots more at yourownhealthandfitness.org. If you want to reach us, please do it by email at admin, at yourownhealthandfitness.org. I'm Lena Berman with with Jeff Fawcett and Dr. Lewis Hagler, H-A-G-L-E-R, M-D. He, with his wife Lisa Goines, RN, have written a wonderful review article called Noise Pollution, a Modern Plague. And we are discussing the health effects of noise pollution. Physical damage to hearing. 100 decibels is what a jackhammer gets up to. It only takes 4 hours, four hours a day, four times a year to damage your hearing from listening. Can you imagine if you live in the city and they're doing this prolonged project? That's sort of it, huh?
Yeah, it doesn't take much. Doesn't take much. The rule of thumb that people follow generally is anything below 70 decibels is safe for any length of time. But when you get to 85 decibels and above, 85 dB is limited in terms of hearing safety to 8 hours. And as you go up from 85 decibels, the amount of time that you can safely be exposed to sound above that level becomes increasingly smaller, increasingly less. And, you know, by the time you get up to over the threshold of pain is somewhere around
140.
140,
it says.
Yeah, 120, 140, depending on what you read. But at those levels, your limits become a matter of minutes.
Yeah, it says here that if you're exposed to 165, I'm going from your article, 165 decibels, it takes a few milliseconds to have acute cochlear damage. And you also mentioned that 140 decibels is about the loudness of a car with those enormous bassy speakers in them.
Yes, the so-called boom cars.
Yeah.
And of course, part of that, Lena, depends on the duration of the sound. For example, gunshots, which have a very, very short duration, but they're incredibly loud. That kind of impulsive sound is very damaging to the ear.
Mm-hmm. So anyway, once again, ears don't get used to loud noise. So
yes, and the other thing ears can't do is we can't turn them off.
True enough, we can't turn them off at night. Spoken communication. I watched my father lose his hearing as he aged, and I observed how it made him sort of insane. He never really admitted it, but he was having a horrible time understanding people, and it agitated him greatly. So spoken communication gets destroyed rather quickly as this goes on.
Yes, and that has real public health implications because it affects people's ability to get gainful employment or to work effectively in school environments. It creates real social and economic handicaps that as you point out, are for the people who are affected, are very frustrating, and for their loved ones, it makes life very difficult.
But it really also it occurs to me that if you're brought up in a socioeconomic environment that's very poor, where there really are gunshots and loud boom cars and loud traffic and machinery and all of that, and your ears are being damaged as a fetus before you're even born, and then as a child, by the time you get to school, you're just out of luck.
Well, that's true, although I'm not sure how much all of the noise that washes over us really is. There is no question that we are awash in noise, and there have been studies that show if you test large populations of people that their hearing in age groups, if you study, say, age groups, the 70 to 80-year-old people, and you look at that cohort of age groups over time, you find that over time, hearing decreases. So not only is there a decrease in hearing as normally as a result of aging, but because we're exposed to so much noise, there is that much more decrement in our mm-hmm. hearing ability mm-hmm. as we get old. So mm-hmm. clearly there is that part of it that we're awash in noise, and it does affect our hearing. But I think more importantly, I think, are the other effects, the non-auditory effects of
hearing.
Well,
let's get into the next one, which is sleep, which is probably one of the most interesting of all.
Yes. Sleep is a very interesting business. Now, we talked about the costs of noise pollution in terms of gross national product. The National Commission on Sleep Disorders has put out a figure that says sleep deprivation costs about $150 billion a year because of stress, reduced productivity, and increased accidents. The National Sleep Foundation estimates that somewhere between 50 and 70 million Americans suffer from chronic sleep problems. And these problems, of course, decrease work and school performance, they increase accidents, and they decrease overall health, and they certainly decrease what we call quality of life.
Well, what's really interesting about the sleep stuff is that, first of all, again, I'm taking this from your paper, that you can have your sleep disrupted, not to the point of being awakened, but it's an annoyance while you're asleep, at levels that are very, very low, very low levels of noise. In other words, you talk about how anything over 30 decibels that's continuous will disrupt your sleep pattern.
Mm-hmm.
And
it doesn't have to wake you to cause the problems that you can measure, that are measurable and predictable.
The other thing that's interesting is something that I have observed because I've tried using earplugs in certain situations, that very low frequency sound is the most disturbing. And, you know, so very, very deep bass sounds mm-hmm. or the thumping sound of a machine or something, mm-hmm. those, and I always have found those that makes me homicidal, actually. But so what we're saying is that the sleep disruption can happen in a way that you're not even completely aware that you're just disrupted. It just keeps you out of certain levels of sleep that help you repair your memory and all the rest of it.
That's
so
right.
You can't.
You wake up in the morning and you feel tired and you don't know why. You're fatigued the mm-hmm. next day. Mm-hmm. Your performance is somehow not quite what it ought to be, and it's because your sleep has been disrupted during the night, but not to the level that it's awakened you, but sufficiently disrupted that it's interfered with the restorative properties that we normally get from a good night's sleep.
I can see I have to talk to my one of my cats sleeps with me and he snores, so I'm going to have to talk to him because he is waking me up. I think he realizes.
The other thing, Lena, is
You did one of those things. I wanted to say also there's an article in today's Associated Press about the fact that if your sleep is just not the right depth of sleep, then one of the things that happens in sleep is you're working on your memory, both somewhat in dreaming, but even at a deeper level of sleep than dreaming, you're working on memory and learning. And when you're not sleeping deeply or you're not achieving that level of sleep for any number of reasons, your learning and memory are destroyed. I thought that was an appropriate thing to mention there. But, you know, this is, again, a fight-or-flight response, and it's amazing how, I mean, if you think that, like I said in the frame, that a normal quiet neighborhood is 45 decibels, and that's pretty quiet, you know, 30 decibels is what you need at night, anything above it, and you're disrupted. So it doesn't take much.
Nope, it doesn't.
So one of the things that this dovetails into is cardiovascular health because of the fight-or-flight response that your body is going through, which is not really how you're supposed to be all the time chronically. And if you're, I can attest to this. I mean, anyone who's lived in a noisy neighborhood or have lived near a construction zone for a while, it just wrecks your life. And again, kids are most at risk.
Well, we're all at risk, and the business about fight or flight that occurs during sleep, and that's one of the significant issues is that you may be sleeping and there may be environmental noise that's not loud enough to wake you up from your sleep, but it is loud enough to trigger all of the responses in terms of heart rate and blood pressure and outpouring of hormones that are characteristic of the fight or flight response. And so you get all the ill effects of that, even though you're not awake or aware of it. It's because it's a reflex, and it happens even while you're sleeping because your ears never turn off, so they're always tuned to whatever noises are in the environment.
And as you said, people can be startled by sound or exposure to constant loud noise can cause you to have such a constantly sort of sympathetic dominant nervous system that you're in an eek state all the time, which increases your chance of getting a heart attack.
Yeah, you never get back to a normal baseline because you're constantly being stimulated. The other you mentioned, I was going to say, you mentioned about earplugs and
the low level noise.
Yeah, the problem, of course, is that low frequency noise penetrates everything.
Yes,
and you cannot block. You really cannot block it out unless you. I mean, if you put up a wall that's about 10 feet thick,
stone,
a concrete wall that's about 10 feet thick, you can block it out, but. Low-frequency noise, these sound waves have, they're enormously long, and they're very powerful, and they go right through everything. So they go right through the walls of our homes or our apartments. They, they're everywhere. And you can't block them out with earplugs. That's
so,
sure.
So along with the obvious boom cars with a loud bass and possibly some kind of piece of equipment that's thumping or something, what else would have that frequency?
Well, home theater systems now where people have put in, speakers in all four corners of the room, and then they've got a giant bass speaker that's non-directional that puts out very low frequency sound so that, if you're involved in a car chase, the whole room is going to be vibrating like you're riding in a car. Motorcycles.
I hate motorcycles.
Many. I think that many of the car makers now are putting mufflers on their vehicles that have a low frequency rumble to them.
Yes.
Because for whatever reason, people find that sexy or glamorous, but
they like the resonance in their body. They like the vibration, but
yeah,
it's disrupting to your heart rate. It actually changes your heart rate.
Well, it changes the heart rate of everybody who. who happens to be nearby as that vehicle rumbles by.
You're listening to Your Own Health and Fitness. This is Lena Berman. I'm with Dr. Lewis Hagler, H-A-G-L-E-R. His article, Noise Pollution, will be up on our website at yourownhealthandfitness.org, and we're talking about noise pollution and health. It mentions, in terms of cardiovascular risk, that, the motorcycle thing makes me nuts. I'll go back to that in a second. Children are at risk as well. Children who live in noisy environments have been shown to have elevated blood pressures and elevated levels of stress-induced hormones. So,
That's right. And poor performance.
Yep,
in schools.
Sure. There are a number. There's a large number of groups that are involved in. Consumer groups that are involved in noise, anti-noise activists, you know, various sorts, and you refer to some of them in the, we'll probably have a few links on our website, but I was reading some of those, and I think it was on one of those that I saw that there's a proposal to add speakers that make sound to Prius cars, Prius automobiles, because they're silent. And
yes.
It doesn't say that they're doing it because they're afraid they're going to hit somebody. You know, in other words, it isn't because it's not clear why.
I'll tell you how that's come about. I think there's been lobbying on the part of the blind community.
Oh.
Who?
Oh dear.
Because those cars are so quiet.
Yeah.
They don't hear them.
That's true.
And so there has been a lot of discussion about what can be done to. Make those cars safe for people who don't see and who depend on their hearing to be safe when they're out on the street and they have to cross an intersection or whatever. And there are commercial ventures that are looking at trying to, rather than just making those cars noisier, having some sort of signaling device that would be audible for short distances, and perhaps even having some kind of a receiver mechanism that the blind individual could carry that would alert him.
Yeah, but then that's going to be radio frequency. Oh, dear. Anyway, okay, well, that explains that.
It's an interesting dilemma.
It is an interesting problem. It is an interesting problem. Moving on, there is the disturbances in mental health.
Well, as much as we would like to be able to say that noise affects mental health, there really is no good evidence for that. And
it is one of the things that you mention as
What it does is it may aggravate the mental health abnormalities that pre-exist, so that people who have underlying mental disorders.
I don't think you have to have an underlying mental disorder. I mean, if you're in an environment where there is a constant annoyance, you still there? Hello? Dr. Hagler?
Yes.
Oh, good. I'm getting strange phone sounds. You still with us? Is your phone... Your phone is running. Your battery's dying?
Okay.
Okay, you switched phones.
Yes.
Okay.
Sorry.
No, it's okay. I just wondered what it was.
I was having a red light flashing. It was panic time.
Yeah, your battery. Yeah. If you have a constant annoyance in your environment and you're in a constant state of fight or flight and sympathetic dominance and it's an annoyance, you don't have to have a history of mental health disturbances to reach a point where your quality of life has been destroyed so particularly that you're not sleeping, as you mentioned, people become depressed, and in some cases, people become violent because of disputes over noise.
Well, our newspapers are full of that. If you watch the papers, you'll see, if not every day, several times a week, where there are arguments that erupt in a neighborhood because one neighbor tells another neighbor to turn down the volume of their car radio or their stereo in their home, and all of a sudden it escalates and gets violent, and then people come out with guns and there's shootings or killings, and it's so common.
I think it wears people down.
It does.
And you can't, it's very hard to keep remembering that somebody has a right to be alive over there if they're destroying your peace of mind.
And what it does is it alters, it provokes people into unwanted behaviors.
Yeah.
It makes normal people violent.
I once gave somebody a music appreciation class who lived, when I was living in a very densely populated area, I was trying to sit in the backyard and he was playing some heavy metal music, which is not my preference. So I went and got a portable player, CD player, and I put on Leonard Stark cello playing Bach, and I chose the loudest, bassiest Bach cello music I could find, and I turned it up to its absolute highest level. And he tried turning his up for a while, and we sort of stayed like that for a while, and then he finally stopped. So I did, you know, I mean, and I try to behave myself. I don't always succeed, but I'm not usually a violent person, but I thought he might need some Bach cello music.
Well, you know, it's interesting that people have looked at some of the social effects of noise. And in noisy environments, there have been a number of studies that have shown that people are less prone to help others. They're less altruistic.
Yeah, I would think so.
And those are clearly noise-related effects. So if we're awash in noise, it kind of shaves a few layers of the veneer of civility off of all of us, which is too bad.
Yeah, I'm sure it does. Let's move on to impaired task performance. This is a no-brainer. If your cognitive children in these loud environments have decreased cognitive development, if they're living near highways and airports, huh?
Right.
Yeah.
Right. Or if they're on one side of the school that's noisy, when you compare those to the children on the other side of the school where it's quiet, their performance is poorer. Their academic achievement is less. And in some cases where they've been followed carefully, it's a whole year of academic performance that children in noisy environments fall behind. So it's school performance, it's work performance, it's accidents, it's safety. All of those things are tied up with, and again, it's all linked together, all linked to sleep. So if you don't get enough sleep, then your task performance is impaired and you're fatigued and you're prone to make mistakes. And I think it's interesting that, some of the biggest disasters that we faced in our environment have occurred at night, where at least part of the explanation has been operator fatigue. And I'm thinking of the Bhopal disaster in India, Chernobyl.
Oh yeah.
And Three Mile Island.
Valdez is another one. The Exxon Valdez.
Exxon Valdez would be another one where there was operator fatigue.
Yes.
At least as part of the explanation.
Yes.
For what went wrong.
Yes, but and then as you, your last point is negative social behavior and annoyance reactions, and then you talk again in that area about the vibration and low frequency components, people working around loud machines and things like that. But, you know, another thing is just the individual nature of the reaction. I mean, I've had people say to me, oh, just block it out. I just block it out. And I can't, you know, some of us can't. Some of us cannot block it out. People have different types of nervous systems. There are some people who can sleep on an airplane or something, and other people, you know, can't, and never in a million years. So people are individual, and the sad thing here is that regulation needs to be somewhere in the middle so that there's some protection for our health. I mean, the point is that what we've learned from your paper is that whether or not you think you're blocking it out, your body isn't blocking it out, and you're having some physical reactions, and your ears are being damaged by this. So if you think that you like the vibration and the noise and the booming and the this, you just want to kind of keep in mind that not being able to hear later in life doesn't just mean that things are quieter. It means that you can't understand what people are saying to you. And it's very agitating and upsetting when that happens, and it's hard to admit. So what's to be done?
Well, what's to be done?
You mentioned that local control has not been successful.
Yes. What we need are enlightened legislators. We need enlightened laws to be passed that are aimed at protecting the, you know, the law doesn't need to protect the most sensitive. It needs to protect the average. We need to, you know, looking at the middle of the bell curve, that's the group of people that we want to protect. If we protect them, we'll get most of the others, except the ones at the very top end. So we need enlightened legislators. We need enlightened laws. We need our police departments to enforce the laws that exist, and we need everyone to recognize that all of us need and desire a certain amount of quiet in our lives, so there's a certain amount of basic respect for other human beings and for their rights. I don't think, you know, just because someone has got $1,000 worth of stereo equipment in his car, that his right to make noise trumps my right to quiet.
So briefly, because we're almost completely out of time, what can we do as consumers?
I think what we have to do is we have to complain whenever it's noisy, restaurants and stores. We have to be active with our city council people and let them know that we want them to give us a quieter environment, because it will be a safer and healthier environment. Everybody, what we need to do as a society is we need to turn down the volume.
In every way possible, yes.
In every way possible.
Make some room and some solace for people. Well, I thank you, both you and Lisa, Dr. Hagler, for writing this very inspiring review article with all its references and having it published in a peer review. I'm sure it will get some people's attention. We will have it on our website. Again, Dr. Lewis Hagler and his wife, whose name is not right in front of me, Lisa Goines. Sorry. And the article is Noise Pollution, a Modern Plague. So, again, thank you so much for the work.
Thank you.
Okay. I want to thank you all for listening. I'm Lena Berman. Visit our website, yourownhealthandfitness.org, for easier extended access to our over 600 archive shows with our library card feature. Get a free stream of this week's show, information about our book, Too Much Medicine, Not Enough Health, and lots more at yourownhealthandfitness.org. If you want to reach us, email us at admin@yourownhealthandfitness.org. Your Own Health and Fitness is produced by Lena Berman and Dr. Jeffrey Fawcett. Remember, being informed not only protects your health, it protects your freedom.